Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
You gotta understand something here. This music is the glue of the world. It holds it all together. Without this, life would be meaningless.
So crazy about. It's just music.
Asked to name the most influential punk rock album in history, you'd be hard-pressed to top the Ramones' Rocket to Russia. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kotz. We'll dissect the 1977 punk classic and hear from the late Tommy Ramone. And later, we review the newest album from Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. That's all coming up on Sound Opinions. This is Sound Opinions, and later on in the show, Jim, we're going to review this new Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers album. Now, you and I have both interviewed Petty a few times before, including once in unison on an old version of Sound Opinions.
Greg, I'm sorry that episode's not in the archive, because it's one of our favorite moments ever. Tom Petty turned all 17-year-old fanboy, recollecting driving around in Hawaii beside his friend George Harrison on a bulldozer going through Harrison's farm. Classic moment. I won't say what Harrison was growing, but Petty had a good laugh about it. That's the review later in the show, but first we have some music news. That is the Robert Johnson classic, Last Fair Deal Gone Down. Appropriate, Johnson being one of the many people who never got his fair deal from the music industry. Greg, it's rare to have a coalition of labels in the music business agree on anything, but more than 700 indie labels, including some of the most respected in the music world, Domino, Cooking Vinyl, Epitaph, Secretly Canadian, the whole beggars group of 4AD, Matador, Rough Trade, have come together to sign something that they're calling the Fair Digital Deals Declaration. This is like the Declaration of Independence in terms of its idealism. There are 5 key points that these indie labels are making. Number 1, they are asking everybody who signed and everybody else in the music world to clearly explain in recording contracts and royalty statements all digital revenues to their artists. Seems like a very reasonable request. Number 2, that artists share in a good faith pro rata system of collecting digital revenues. And that means not only from sales, but from a specific use in commercials and stuff like that. Number 3, to encourage better standards of reporting from all the digital rights services and streaming services. Number 4, to support artists who choose to oppose any unauthorized use of their music digitally, and finally, to support the collective position of all of the independent record companies of the world. In a codicil to this, the main group is called the Worldwide Independent Network, but there's another Fair Digital Deals Declaration that is saying very pointedly to the major labels, it is not fair for the major labels and superstar artists to sign better digital rights deals for their artists and their labels than it is for everybody else. Everybody, in other words, should be treated equally. It's much like the idea of net neutrality. Everybody should be equal on the net.
You know, we asked a few of these indie labels to comment on this declaration, and we got a statement from the Beggars Group founder and chairman, Martin Mills. He said, quote, it's a declaration of policy and belief, and oversight will take place between each artist and label. Now, Jim, I got to say, I'm a little bit skeptical about this, because as a statement of intent, it's all well and good. It's impressive that there are over 700 labels involved in this. But I'm wondering if it's going to have any real effect. It doesn't have any real oversight, and it doesn't really have any sense of enforcement. So it might as well be business as usual. That is the Russian punk group Pussy Riot. They've been in the news a lot the last 2 or 3 years. Now they're in the news again because two members of this feminist group are suing the Russian government in the European Court of Human Rights for their imprisonment over the protests that they threw in that cathedral near the Kremlin in February 2012. The women were imprisoned for nearly a couple of years over this protest, and now they're saying that their human rights were violated and that they were subject to what amounted to torture. One of their spokesmen said they didn't get a fair trial here in Russia, so they want to finally get it right in the European Court of Human Rights. Plus, they want their case to set a precedent that Russians can speak publicly on sensitive political issues, even if this speech is not supported by the majority. This is a case about freedom of expression and fair trial, first of all. That's a key point because surveys have shown that the vast majority of the Russian population is in support of what the Russian government did in prosecuting the band for this protest. They consider it sacrilegious that they would perform in this cathedral a track like Mother of God, Drive Putin Out. This was not deemed a proper behavior from the Russian population. But the women in the band are saying that they were mistreated during the trial, and they're going to fight this thing to the end. The Russian government has been moved yet again to respond to what's going on here. They issued a statement saying deliberately provocative behavior in a place that is dedicated to the spiritual needs of believers and is a symbol of the Russian Orthodox community clearly undermines tolerance and cannot be seen as a normal, sincere exercise of the rights of the convention. One thing remains clear, Pussy Riot remains a thorn in the side of the Russian government.
Teenage Lobotomy by the Ramones. What a song. You're listening to Sound Opinions, and from time to time, we like to do a classic album dissection, diving deep into the history of a record that we think is one for the ages. That certainly applies to Rocket to Russia, the Ramones' 1977 release, which is really the best of the Ramones' early records, and it was produced by Tommy Ramone.
Yes, it was, Jim. Tommy died last month, and with that, punk rock lost a true founding father, drummer, producer, and really guiding force of the Ramones. But this gives us an occasion to revisit a 2007 conversation with him about his influence on the band and about Rocket to Russia specifically.
Greg, in appreciating Rocket to Russia, one of the things that you have to understand right off the bat is what a breath of fresh air something like that song Teenage Lobotomy was in the mid-70s. You know, Genesis, Yes, James Taylor, Loggins and Messina, the Eagles, that was the stuff that was ruling the airwaves. There was a real lack of energy in rock and roll. There was no excitement. There was no fun. There was no spirit. A lot of critics, some people in the music industry, some musicians thought, how did rock and roll get away from Chuck Berry in the 50s and the British Invasion and the Beach Boys and come to be mired down in these tales of topographic oceans, this progressive rock flatulence? What happened to rock and roll?
I think Seymour Stein at Sire Records was asking that same question because he signed the Ramones after seeing them at CBGB's, the infamous Lower East Side Club. And they put out their debut record in April of 1976, and it was that breath of fresh air. It was the first real big salvo in the punk rock movement in the United States. They toured England for the first time a few months later. In fact, July 4th, 1976, first show in London, where the Sex Pistols were there, the future members of The Clash were there, The Damned were there, and they go, right. Oh my God, we have just seen our future.
The flip side of the British invasion. It was the American invasion.
Exactly.
In
a couple months later, they released another record, and then their third album came out in November of 1977.
The Ramones always recorded for a major label, and they were under the sponsorship of Seymour Stein, who thought they were going to be a hit. So for the third album, he really invested in them. First album was made for $6,000. Album number three, Rocket to Russia, they spent $25,000 and went to a studio in Midtown Manhattan called Media Sound in the middle of the summer to record this record.
Exactly. You had these four guys from the far, far suburbs of New York City, Forest Hills, blue-collar guys, getting together in a band essentially with the idea to restore some of what they loved and weren't hearing in rock and roll anymore. They loved that early Brill Building stuff, the Brill Building pop songs of Carole King, the Phil Spector sound of the early 60s, the craft of those songs, the catchy, undeniable craft of Beach Boys songs. They weren't hearing any of this on the radio anymore, and they wanted to make some songs in their own image. The fact is that it had been 15 years since, though, and they'd updated the sound quite a bit. I mean, what I think they did, Jim, that was innovative was to take that early 60s sound that they loved so much, that bubblegum and that pop sound, and take all the fat out of it and just turn it into this speed train, rev it up by about, 150 miles an hour, and turn it into these rush of pop songs. So instead of a 2.5 or 3 minute song, you would get a minute long or a minute and a half long song.
Exactly.
That just blew the doors off.
Exactly. Now, it's easy to forget at this point in time where, you have a Fall Out Boy and a Blink 182 and Sum 41 in every shopping mall in America, how revolutionary this was at the time. There was no punk rock. There was no phrase. Punk was somebody who was a turning homosexual tricks, okay? The Ramones took this name and they decided to wear it as a badge of pride and to dress like idiots from the street, but they weren't. They really were. Only D.D., Douglas Colvin, the bass player, he was the real deal. He was the guy who was actually sniffing glue. But Jeff Hyman, who would become Joey Ramone, was a smart, educated guy. John Cummings was a street smart guy, loved baseball. And then you had Greg Tommy Ramone, better known to his parents anyway as Tomas Erdely, who was born in Budapest, not even an American, immigrated to the U.S. And key part in forming one of the iconic American bands. He was a little older than the other guys. He'd been a studio intern when Jimi Hendrix was recording Band of Gypsies. He knew the music industry, and he had this vision for a band. Here's one of the songs he co-wrote, Cretin Hop, classic from Rocket to Russia. Tommy was really the forgotten Ramone. He had a career after the Ramones and even went on to produce the Replacements. But sadly, as we mentioned, he died in July. We spoke to him in 2007, and at the time, he was the last surviving original member of the Ramones. We began the conversation with how he met his bandmates.
I met John in the high school cafeteria the first day of high school, and we bonded right away through music. He was a really witty, funny guy. And Dee Dee moved into the neighborhood like about a year or two later. And Joey, I knew. Actually, I met Joey before I met Johnny at some weird jam session where he was playing a snare drum. Mm-hmm. This was when I was about 15, 16. And he was like 14, and he was just hitting the snare drum, looking really strange.
Yeah, he always did. Well, started out as a Ramones drummer.
Exactly. I was going to say that. That's where the band started. Joey as the drummer of the band. And you were going to manage the band, as I understand. Right, Tommy?
Yeah, I was originally the manager. They were sort of a concept of mine. I mean, I had seen the New York Dolls, and I really enjoyed them. I saw that what they were doing, you know, wasn't very virtuosic, but they were like the most exciting band I'd seen in a long time. And I just thought about, well, I know these guys in Forest Hills. If I could get them together, they might be interesting. And so I encouraged them to get some instruments and do that. And so at first rehearsal, I was like, I didn't know what to expect. I knew it would be colorful and interesting. But they showed up with these like really strange, bizarre songs. And I said, wow, we got a little extra here. These guys are coming up with these very unique songs. So things got going pretty quickly, you know, right from the start.
So the satirical take on suburban life and the state of the family and drugs and street culture, this was all in terms of the subject matter, was there from the start.
Yeah, they came in with lots of baggage.
Before we get to some of the songs, I want to ask you in particular about being a drummer. I'm a drummer myself, and I think the Ramones never get enough credit for their influence in rock on drumming because it was so simple and yet revolutionary. The tempos are extraordinary. The 16th notes on the hi-hat. Where did that revved up energy come from? Was it a natural expression? I mean, there was really no rhythm like that, and today it's ubiquitous, so I think we take it for granted. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Partially, it comes down to Johnny, who wanted to be a baseball player. When he used to pitch stickball with us, he would throw fastballs. So yeah. He was a big fastball pitcher. So when he started playing guitar, his virtuosity became speed. Joey was playing drums at first, was trying to keep up with that. And his drums would fall apart after every song, literally.
Yeah.
That's not an exaggeration. So we'd have to pick up the pieces after every song. When I became the drummer, I never played drums before. I was a guitar player.
Really? So you'd never sat down beside the drums?
No, I never played drums ever before that. But I knew what I wanted to hear, which I couldn't get other drummers to play. So right away, I pretty much clicked in with something that matched Johnny's forward drive. And a lot of the things I was doing was probably backwards to what a normal drummer would do, like on cymbal crashes and things like that. I would sometimes do cymbal crashes where opposite of where somebody else would do it. I just wanted to play what I heard in my head.
Tommy, we want to ask you about Rocket to Russia. Your third album came out in 1977. You were the co-producer. Was there a sense that this was the Ramones moment, that this was the time that you were going to break into the top 10, that you were actually going to have singles on the commercial radio airwaves?
Yeah. Well, that record is the Ramones at their peak. By that time, we were really playing well and fluidly. We had a lot of confidence. We thought that we were going to make it because we knew we were good. We were getting good reviews and everything. We had the momentum. And we were, you know, this was inspiring us to write great songs. So we were writing some good songs. And we had a little more money, thus a little more time in the studio. And so all these things came together.
Had you toured much at that
point?
Yeah,
we were touring constantly. We had been to England for the first time for sure. So we could really play well then. As far as the studio was concerned, it was great because that was just me and my co-producers and an engineer, you know? And the Ramones would come in and do the basic tracks, and then Dee Dee and Johnny would leave. And then we would do Joey's vocals, and then he would leave, and then boom. So for me, this was just ecstasy because we were just there to create. I mean, it was still a relatively small budget, so we had to really work hard and fast. But it was one of the greatest times of my life to be able to work on that record. We knew that, wow, you know, this thing is really great. Do you want to stand there with my hand? Tell me that.
We'll have more of our conversation with the late Tommy Ramone about Rocket to Russia after a quick break here on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX. And later, Jim and I review a new album by Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. My partner is Greg Kot, and we're in the middle of our dissection of the classic Ramones album, Rocket to Russia, from 1977. Tommy Ramone, the founding drummer and producer of that album, died a few weeks ago at the age of 65, so we're revisiting our 2007 conversation with him.
Now, you probably noticed that the sounds you're hearing aren't the Ramones, but fellow punks, the Sex Pistols. There was always a little friendly competition between the New York band and their British peers. In fact, Ed Stasium, who engineered Rocket to Russia, was quoted as saying that Johnny Ramone showed up on the first day of recording with that Sex Pistols single, God Save the Queen, and he announced, "These guys ripped us off, and I want to sound better than this." The punk thing was just starting to bubble under in England, and was inspired in many ways by the Ramones tour there the previous summer in 1976. So I asked Tommy Ramone if all of this was reflected back on what they were trying to do in the studio while recording Rocket to Russia. Here he is in 2007 talking about that rivalry.
Well, naturally, we were very competitive. And we liked that record. And we saw that they were taking what we were doing. And they were going into really high-priced studios with high-priced people.
They spent a lot of money.
They spent a lot of money. And they got to, you know. But we listen to it and we say, well, hey, we got to beat this thing.
Production starts to become interesting on Rocket to Russia. You know, Sheena's a punk rocker, has sleigh bells, right? You know, it's beautiful. It's a Phil Spector touch, but three times as fast.
You know, I'm kind of hung up and preoccupied with being tasteful. Mm. I mean, anything that we incorporated had to be... It had to work with the song, and we were always adding those little touches, even in the first record, you know, which we did in like 2 hours. But a lot of that stuff is almost subliminal. You can barely hear it, and just in the background, just to add a little color, a little flavor, sometimes a little humor.
You took out all the fat, I think. There was just no filler. I mean, it's like every note, every drum beat, every word had to mean something, had to count.
Yeah, we did a lot of editing out of things that weren't necessary or weren't cool.
Mm-hmm. There isn't a song on the album that even hits 3 minutes.
We didn't want it to go on any longer than it had to.
Say what you got to say and get out of the way.
Get out.
Did you know Sheena is a Punk Rocker was a great song? I mean, I've always said if we had to choose one song to put in a time capsule, shoot into space, explain to an alien civilization what is rock and roll, It is that song.
Yeah, Seymour Stein especially loved that song, and he sent us into the studio just to record that one song. Mm. Yeah, it's a great song. Joey was brilliant at coming up with these sort of unique, very melodic pop songs. He was amazingly talented with that. I think we were a little ahead of our times, too, though. We were just as good as Sheena's a Punk Rocker is, it's still... maybe a bit too quirky, you know. It didn't seem that way to us. But we were just a little bit ahead of our times, a little over people's heads, I think. And so who knows?
Yeah.
I noticed there was another apocalyptic event on Rocket to Russia in terms of Ramone's lore, and that was a guitar solo by Johnny Ramone on Here Today, Gone Tomorrow. There was actually a few bars there where you could say, well, that's kind of a guitar solo there. Was that how did that come about? Did you have to, like, prod Johnny?
I went into the studio and recorded it.
You played it?
Yeah.
Did
there
you really?
You
oh, yeah. So it's your guitar playing. Okay, now the secret's out. I don't think I've heard that anywhere before. That's great.
You didn't piss him off, did you? Because I wouldn't want Johnny mad at me.
No, he didn't mind that.
Okay.
No.
Now, what made you think, well, a guitar solo would be appropriate on a Ramone song? That's the first time one had been actually played on a Ramone song.
Actually, one of my favorite guitar solos was on the Rolling Stones' Tell Me. Mm. It's basically the same solo. Mm-hmm. I just love that solo because it was so simple. It's just arpeggios. And I just love that. And I said, boy, that would be great in this song. So that's kind of how that ended up there.
Dee Dee Ramone is counting off a number of the songs, which gives the impression that it's very live. Was that in fact how the rhythm tracks were recorded? Dee Dee's counting them off, and boom, the band's off to the races, and that's how it's going to go in the studio. Obviously, the live performances were that like that.
When we first started rehearsing, Dee Dee was the lead singer, and he would count off the songs, and we just thought it was the most hilarious thing we ever heard. You know, and so we would encourage him to do that. So we just kept that in. And yes, those counts in the studio are real. And his counts had absolutely nothing to do with the speed of the songs.
Yeah, I was going to say. Yeah.
Absolutely nothing. He would count off a song and when he would say the word four, we would just come in at the right speed.
There you go. One, two, three, four.
Is there a track on the record that you really love? You know, one that sort of stands out above the others in terms of your appreciation?
There's so many. This record has so many great songs. Cretan Hop, Rockaway Beach, We're a Happy Family.
Yeah.
Is, you know, these are all great songs.
Sitting here in Queens eating refried beans, wearing all the magazines, gulping down Thorazine.
Really, really funny, really dark songs.
It might be a little bit twisted, certainly for the tastes of the 1970s. It just shouldn't go this way or something.
Yeah. Even Rockaway Beach, I heard, was not a pretty place. And yet the song was sort of celebrating this kind of idyllic beach, like as if it was in a Beach Boys song, right? Is that correct?
Yeah. Dee Dee was the one that would go to the beach. That's his song. And I think it's definitely one of my favorites. And I think that definitely should have been a hit if it wouldn't have been released in the middle of January.
That too. Well, yeah, but also anybody who lived in New York, I grew up in New York, you know, you go to Rockaway Beach, you're going to get a syringe in your foot or a razor blade or you're going to get mugged. I mean, that's
not a pretty place.
It wasn't the nicest beach in New York. No.
And these guys are singing this celebratory beach song about it. That's great.
Later went on to produce several of their other albums, but this is the last one you played on. Why did you give it up?
Well, the thing is, what made those guys so great, what made them so talented and everything, also made them very hard to be with 24 hours, 7 days a week, and traveling with them in a small van. They were in a world that where it's hard to keep your sanity. There was something very unreal about them, and like I said, it made for great creativity, made for great music, great ideas. But I needed to keep a little touch with reality.
Tommy Ertelai, Tommy Ramone, one of the greatest drummers for my money in rock history, and one of the members of the most influential bands ever. Thanks for being here on Sound Opinions.
Well, thanks very much. I enjoyed this.
The late, great Tommy Ertelai, Tommy Ramone, speaking to us in 2007 about one of our favorite Ramones releases and one that he produced, Rocket to Russia.
We like to wrap up these classic album dissections, Greg, by each picking a track that we want to highlight. Why don't you go first?
You know, Jim, it's almost impossible to pick just one song, but one of the things that Tommy said in our interview with him that sort of inspired my choice for a track to play from this record is the fact that they were ahead of their time and that they were a little darker and a little more subversive than maybe the mainstream was ready for at that particular moment. And I think the Ramones, among the many reasons that they formed the band and played the way they did, was they wanted to write music and write songs and lyrics that addressed issues that weren't being addressed in popular culture at all at the time. For example, in the song We're a Happy Family, it is a complete repudiation of everything that pop culture was telling us about the American family at
Leave
that time.
Leave It to Beaver and the sitcom family.
Yeah, you know, Ozzie and Harriet, Leave It to Beaver. We had Happy Days as one of the most, as maybe the most popular show in America at the time. In only a couple more years, we would get The Cosby Show. These kind of weirdly idyllic representations of what family life was like. And the Ramones were, I didn't grow up in a house like that.
Nobody did.
And we don't know anybody who did. We want to write a song that is more representative of the kind of families we grew up in. And so, yes, they did exaggerate, and they did turn it into a bit of a comic book, but it was hilarious. And it resonated much more deeply with people who could identify with that more darker aspect of the American family life situation than what they were seeing represented in the larger culture at large. You know, to my mind, it was a brilliant pop song as well. You know, we talked to Tommy about what a great drummer he is. I mean, talk about the supersonic metronome. This is like half speed for Tommy, and even this song is about twice as fast as anything else on American radio at the moment. And then you got to love the little pop culture reference at the end to Todd Browning's Freaks. The Freaks are taking over, and the Ramones are sort of babbling over the top as the song ends, and one of them is saying, "Where's my safety pin? Where's my safety pin?" And it was a little shout out to the British punks who were sort of turning punk into a fashion statement at the time. The Ramones wanted none of that as well. So here it is. We're a Happy Family from the Ramones on Sound Opinions. We'll be right back.
The Ramones, we're a happy family. Greg, we should inject here that the Ramones actually were anything but for the last 15 years or so of their career. In fact, Joey and Johnny didn't even talk to each other. Kind of sad what they became. But at this point, there was a one-for-all, all-for-one quality. This was the turning point in 77 where maybe punk rock was going to rule the world. That would actually happen, but it would take quite some time.
20 years.
a band called Nirvana in 1991, yeah. And as I said earlier, it all eventually leads to Hot Topic in the shopping mall blasting My Chemical Romance, right? Punk is now mainstream, but it wasn't in the Ramones' time. What Seymour Stein heard and loved in Sheena is a Punk Rocker are several things. I mean, A, it's a great song. It's a classic melody. It's got that Phil Spector production. Sleigh bells. There's sleigh bells in the song. How can you not love that, right? But it's also a statement of, we're going to take this word that used to be an insult, punk, and we're gonna claim it as a point of pride. Sheena is a punk rocker. The kids are all hopped up and ready to go. New York City is the place where it's all happening. Those are basically the only words in the song, and yet you can't forget it. I will go to my grave saying, if I had to choose one rock and roll single at 2 minutes and 49 seconds to say this is what this music was about, this is the song. It's impossible to hear this and not be moved. If you hear this and you do not like it, well, you don't like rock and roll. I mean, all due respect, go listen to some jazz or something, okay? But Sheena's a Punk Rocker is a perfect song, and here it is.
Wow, what a great way to wrap up our Ramones discussion of Rocket to Russia. Sheena is a Punk Rocker from 1977 here on Sound Opinions. Now here's a song produced by Tommy Ramone by a band certainly influenced by the Ramones, The Replacements. And we want to hear from you. What are your thoughts on this album? And now that we've lost the final original Ramone, what will you miss most about the band? Sound off at 888-859-1800.
Coming up, Greg and I will review a new record from another rock and roll veteran, Tom Petty. Then it's my turn to add a song to the Desert Island Jukebox. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.
They cut the grass. There ain't much to break anyway in the fall. And sometimes I
take my place in that loud mouth. You're like a picture on the fridge, it's never stocked with food. You used to live at home, now I stay at the house. And everybody wants to be special here. They call your name out loud and clear. Here comes a regular. Call out your name. Here
Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot with Jim DeRogatis, and that is Tom Petty with a track called American Dream Plan B from the 13th Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers studio album, Hypnotic Eye, just out. Now, Tom Petty, a man who has sold 80 million records since the mid-70s worldwide, 2002, inducted in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, 63 years old, still going strong. He was born in Florida, has lived most of his life in California, and he founded a couple of bands, Mudcrunch, which was a well-respected band out of Florida before Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, and then he was involved in a supergroup that some people may remember from the 80s, the Traveling Wilburys, with Bob Dylan, Roy Orbison, George Harrison, Jeff Lynne. Their debut album sold 6 million records. In fact, Petty could seem to do no wrong from about the early 80s to the early 90s. Every record he put out, whether it was one of his own, whether it was with Traveling Wilburys, whether it was with the Heartbreakers, was selling really, really well. He had a 5 million seller, Full Moon Fever, in 1989. 13 albums total with Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. He keeps returning to this classic rock group to do some of his best work. And here's the latest one. It's called Forgotten Man from Hypnotic Eye by Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers on Sound Opinions. We'll be right back.
That is Forgotten Man by Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers on Sound Opinions, album number 13, The Hypnotic Eye. Greg, to be sure, there is no heavy lifting here going on by Tom Petty and the band. It took them 3 years to make this album, although I think one of its charms is that it sounds like it was knocked out in a weekend by the boys jamming in the rehearsal space. In fact, that's where they did some of the recording. You know, to me, we mentioned that interview we did with Petty more than a decade ago. At that point, he was in town here in Chicago and doing a residency with the Heartbreakers, and they were really doing a lot of blues jamming that at its nastiest moments crossed over into garage rock. And that's the moment when I realized that really, after Neil Young's pairing with Crazy Horse, Petty's partnership with the Heartbreakers, in particular, co-founding members Mike Campbell on guitar and Ben Montana on keyboards, is one of the great rock bands of all time, all right? You know, whether they're just jamming or fuzzing out and rocking hard, there's a lot of hard rocking on this album. Petty said he wanted to make a hard rock record. The riffs aren't particularly original. The rhythms aren't particularly original. And as usual, he's talking about guys who are free-falling through life. You know, losers, grumblers, just on the verge of being whiners, you know? They want their freedom. They don't like the way anything's going on. They're not on the left. They're not on the right. But there's all sorts of things wrong, and Tom Petty's talking about them. But, you know, it's just wonderful. It's a wonderful ride. This is a great driving record. It's a great rock record. It's probably not in the top three Petty records I'd steer you to, but you got to buy it if you like this guy, if you like rock and roll. It's just, you know, I have no problems with this record, even while I'm not thrilled by it, is what I'm saying.
Well, I'm glad you got no problems with the record. I'm sure that Tom Petty doesn't care what you think or what I think or what anyone really thinks about this record.
Which is one of his charms, right?
That's the beauty of Petty, is that there's a certain amount of defiance in everything he does. He's trend defiant. It doesn't matter what else is going on out there. He's going to do exactly what he wants to do every time. And I think that lends itself to the sense of integrity about the guy. I think comparing him to Neil Young is apt, because I think there's a sense of this guy is doing exactly what he wants to do all the time. And it doesn't matter what the industry thinks, what the fans think, what radio thinks. I'm going to do what I do best. He does what he does best when he's with Mike Campbell and the Heartbreakers. This is a great band. Mike Campbell, his guitarist and sidekick, keeps coming up with those big riffs. And the range of this record is impressive. I think the songs are much tighter than he came up with in 2010, that jam-oriented record, Mojo, that you're referring to. This is a much more concise, straight-ahead Tom Petty record in the mold of the stuff that he was doing on his first three or four records. The diminished expectations are a big part of this. I think he's not only talking about himself, but he's talking about America. And who would have thunk that, to my mind, Tom Petty has made one of the best albums in terms of addressing the mood of the country. And I point to a line from that song Shadow People that ends the record. He says, "I ain't on the left, I ain't on the right, I don't even know if I got a dog in this fight.
Well, I ain't on the left, and I ain't on the right, I ain't even sure I got a dog in this fight."
That is classic Florida kind of guy, you know, a lower middle class guy from Florida saying, "You know what? I don't agree with anybody right now."
Yeah.
Because nobody's really speaking for me, the guy who's sort of been forgotten in this planet.
You know, I think few people in rock history have made cranky seem more lovable than Tom Petty.
Well, it's almost patriotic in its own way, and there's something American about this guy. Like, he stands for something that is outside of time. It's a buy it record for me.
So that is a double buy it for Tom Petty and the Hypnotic Eye.
I tell you, little buddy, this whole island is bewitched.
Remember, we were shipwrecked together.
As often as possible on Sound Opinions, we like to take a trip to the desert island, pop a quarter in the desert island jukebox, and play a record we cannot live without. Jim, you're paddling out to the island as we speak.
Yeah, Greg, I really think we needed some alternative to all this classic rock and testosterone in this show. And so I'm turning to one of my favorites, Macy Gray. I'm excited because Macy Gray has a new album coming out in October. She's going to be touring. Macy Gray has worn thin with a lot of people because she is so eccentric and weird. When she debuted early on, she was part of that neo-soul movement right in the same level with Erykah Badu and Jill Scott and D'Angelo for the men. But, you know, the fact that she has a voice which is somewhere between Billie Holiday and Betty Boop, and the fact that she just is like a Martian from another planet. You know, Janelle Monáe does that alien from outer space R&B queen thing, but she's kind of sleek about it, whereas Macy Gray is just kind of a mess. I think that's one of her charms. And I wanted to remind you and everybody else how great that debut album, 1999, On How Life Is, was. Came out and had a slow build, and then all of a sudden she dropped the single I Try. And that's the one that really put her on top. I just love this song. I think it stands as one of the best tunes of the 90s. I Try by Macy Gray from On How Life Is on Sound Opinions.
I believe that fate has brought us here, and we should be together, babe, but we're not. I'll play it off, but I'm dreaming of you, and I'll keep my cool, but I'm feeling I try to say goodbye and I choke. Seem all right and smile when you leave, but my smiles are just a front, just a front.
That is the inimitable Macy Gray with I Try, my Desert Island Jukebox pick for the week. Greg, what do we have on the show next week?
Well, for the record, Jim, I'd like to say that I'm with you on the first two Macy Gray records. I think those are great records as well. It's
maybe
stuff
the new
afterward
one.
That I'm
maybe
not
the
writing.
New one will do it again. Keep an open mind.
But next week, we've got another great artist who's sort of uncategorizable as well. Khalise is going to be in the studio for a live performance and an interview.
Greg, Sound Opinion senior producers are Jason Saldana and Robin Lynn. Our production assistant is Anthony Martinez, and our intern is Sam Taylor.
This happened once before, when I came to your door. no reply.
On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. So give us a call on our hotline, 888-859-1800.
I tried to telephone, they said you were not home. That's a lie, 'cause I know where you've been. I saw you walking your door.
New messages.
Hey, Jim and Greg, this is Brad Brooks Rubin, normally from Tacoma Park, Maryland, but calling right now from the corner of northeast Colorado. I'm on a very long road trip. Most of what I'm listening to came from the recent Pitchfork Festival, which I had the pleasure to attend for the seventh time. But I've been listening between a lot of loud punk rock, a lot of Christian rock. I'm Jewish, but been sort of intrigued. And I started to wonder, most of what's on the radio here seems to be Christian rock, and started to get curious, is there an underground world of quote-unquote Christian rock? Are there critics? It might be interesting for us to learn about what's happening in the world of Christian rock, which has obviously got millions and millions of listeners, and they sell tons of records. And it may be interesting to find a critic who focuses on this and see what's out there.
My name is Vicki. I'm in Raleigh, North Carolina. Listening to Roseanne and her husband today was really a great show. I probably should have looked this up before I called, but I was wondering, have you done Buddy Miller and his wife, Julie Miller? I love their music. It's very spiritual, very loving. And my late husband, he discovered them, and he absolutely adored them. Bye.
Take me back.
Hey guys, this is Daniel Wyant from Chesterton, Indiana. I was just listening to Frank Black's album the other day, and the opening track is Los Angeles, and I thought it would be a great idea if you have a show about songs that are about getting away, you know, leaving it all behind and going to some exotic location. The line that really sticks out in that song is, he wants to go to Los Angeles, not the one in South California, but there's one in South Patagonia. And I think there is a great history of rock and roll songs that are in a similar vein of people who just want to leave it all behind and disappear to some exotic locale. Anyway, thanks for the great show. Love it. Take care.
To give us your opinions on Sound Opinions, call our hotline, 888-859-1800. We'll be back next week with more Sound Opinions, produced by WBEZ Chicago and distributed by PRX.